Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
This week in Retronauts, Octoroks, Tektites, and Levers, too. Hi, everyone, and welcome to, oh man, which episode of Retronauts is this? We've been doing
this
for like 10 years.
It's the 10th Zelda episode.
So it's we've got to have at least 20 episodes under our belts. So welcome to episode 21 of Retronauts. I'm just assigning that number arbitrarily.
21? I think we're in the 60s by now. We're in the 60s. We have to be.
It's all imaginary numbers.
We're counting down.
Welcome to the square root of -1 of Retronauts.
That's exactly right. Quantity is a construct of the human mind. And so are video games, so we're going to talk about those this week. We're going to talk specifically about The Legend of Zelda and Zelda 2.
How have you not talked about Zelda before?
We've talked about Zelda in general, but we've never really...
I've listened to the Zelda episodes.
We've never really drilled deeply into the NES games, because people tend to kind of brush over those.
As the Retronauts historian, I guess, I think the last time this show did an episode on classic Zelda was maybe 2007, so we're about due.
Yeah. I was a listener long-time listener.
And that was the 25th
anniversary. Everything about that game has changed since then.
The way we think
hasn't
changed.
But maybe you didn't dig into Zelda 2?
Definitely not.
Guys, I beat Shadow Link 2 days ago for the first time
ever. Oh, nice.
Wow.
So it's fresh.
Sweet. Okay.
We'll get there, excellent.
Wait, who are you?
I never played Zelda 2. My name is...
No, literally.
This is actually asking for an identification.
Sure. My name is Sam Claiborne. I'm an editor at IGN, and I operate games at Free Gold Watch and Hate Stanyan in the Mission, or the Hate Ashford.
You keep talking that place up. I need to go sometime.
It's a great arcade.
I stayed in a super crazy Airbnb like 2 doors down from that one time.
Really?
Yeah.
But was it above a yoga place? That's a trick question because they're all yoga places.
Yeah. Also, I'm Jeremy Parrish. I'm here as usual, and diagonally from me,
I'm Chris Kohler from Wired, and I'm so hungry I could eat an Octorok.
Wow,
there's some scones
right there.
Oh, cool.
We could do the thing where we eat on the podcast because I know people really like that.
I'm one of those people who really loves that so much that I would.
Oh yeah. No, don't even imitate it.
I literally want to punch
it. Sound is the best.
We just got.
I'll edit that out.
I think we just got 3 1-star reviews for that. And also, I'm Bob Mackey, noted Zelda 2 hater.
Whoa.
I'm sipping on that Zelda 2 haterade, it's delicious.
This is the
That's an unusual and iconoclastic opinion.
We're on the anti-Zelda 2 side of the table, I guess.
Oh, cool.
I never said I was pro-Zelda 2. Well,
you just beat it.
Oh. I need to deconstruct it and decompress it, I guess, in this episode.
This could be therapy, folks. You heard it here first.
We'll see.
Anyway, so yes, in case you haven't figured it out, we're going to talk about Zelda and Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link. More or less on the occasion of their 30th anniversary, or of Zelda's 30th anniversary, which was February 21st. And then Zelda 2 came out in Japan, I want to say February 1987, so it wasn't too far behind. Hmm. So yeah, both of those games are pretty old now, and I remember seeing commercials for them when they were brand new, and that makes me feel very old. I remember waiting for many, many years for Zelda 2 to come to America. Well, I guess it was like a year, but it seemed like so long.
Yeah. Well, that was the first example of... Well, that was the first notable example of a game being announced and like sort of having a release window and then like getting a very conspicuous delay.
This is for Zelda 2.
Because Nintendo had to say the quote unquote chip shortage. Yeah.
We can talk more about that later, but I wonder how much of that was true.
It's not so much a chip shortage as like it probably took them a certain amount of time to manufacture these games, you know, internal components and external components. And they probably realized, like, oh, we actually need a lot of these. Like, the NES has kind of exploded so much in popularity that, like, we can't release this game without, like, exponentially more copies of Zelda 2 than we were originally going to have.
That could be the origin of Nintendo's, you know, just having too few of one thing that everybody's excited about. Just as repeated. Every time they put out a console, every time they put out an amiibo.
Well, actually, like, the NES itself was
Zelda 2.
At that time, Nintendo had, like, their chip manufacturing process, and that was how, right? I mean, like, Nintendo's games, all third-party games, like, Nintendo manufactured everything. Third parties had come to Nintendo and said, we'd like to do our own, you know, chips, and here's factories that we have. And Nintendo was like, no, this is an unacceptable level of quality. So, like, they really had really high standards for the quality of the electrical, you know, electronic
components. I wonder if
that
was the full story there. Nah. I think no, but... Anyway, we'll talk more about that.
Again, Nintendo might people are like, "Oh, Nintendo, you know, they screw third parties because they didn't give them enough of their allotted orders." But Nintendo's not going to screw themselves with a fake chip shortage to like delaying a game doesn't help anybody. Like, I imagine there really was an issue.
I would actually
enough manufactured.
I'm sure that's true.
It's for hype.
Zelda 2 used a cartridge very similar to the first Zelda, except it had an additional like subcomponent to it. It had like an extra 16K of some kind of memory soldered onto it. So it was almost the same, but not quite.
Yeah, isn't it weird how the hardware
really
changed
so
much?
As I think about it, it occurs to me that Zelda launched in America right around the time that the NES really started to pick up steam. And I kind of wonder if they just wanted to delay Zelda 2 so that the first game had more time to breathe. Because lots and lots of kids were still buying NESs all the way up. I think the peak of the NES market in terms of console uptake was 1989. So, like, there were more and more people buying the games. And, you know, NES games were, just in general, games at that point had a different life cycle than they do now. Now they come out, and 3 weeks later, they go on Steam sale or whatever, and the value drops out. But during the Nintendo era, a popular game would stay in circulation for years and years. I mean, the black box games were continuing to show up on store shelves into the 90s.
Imagine a game like Zelda in which nobody could solve it, right?
Right, it was unsolvable. It was a never-ending adventure.
Do you think that explains the Mario 3 18-month gap between America and Japan just to get Mario saturation at its highest level?
One of the parts of the 18-month gap is that Mario 3 came out in Japan, I believe, 1 month after Mario 2 came out in America.
Oh, wow.
That needed some time on the shelves.
Oh, for sure.
That's part of it. Like, they wanted to give the previous game time to breathe.
Same thing. Sure.
So I think it's a combination of factors.
Yeah.
But
and anyway, the delay of Zelda 2
it certainly
was a
didn't
boom to
hurt
third
the game. I mean, it gave other people a chance to, you know, release games, but also, like, it built up this anticipation for Zelda 2. By the time it came out, we were all like, when is Zelda 2 coming?
Right.
I would call, like, the local stores that had electronics sections, like, on a weekly basis. I would call all of them and say, do you have Zelda 2 yet? This was in the summer, like, 6 months before that.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's some speculation that they released a very limited quantity of Zelda 2 in the U.S. because it was actually announced, I think, at the same time as Zelda. Like, there are promotional materials that are, like, new, coming soon, Zelda and Zelda 2. And then Zelda 2 didn't show up for, you know, like 2 or 3 years later.
Nintendo Power, they actually used issues to address the shortage, too. So
yeah.
It was their
propaganda mouthpiece.
Totally.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't – I personally think it's very unlikely that they would have released just a few games and then said, oh, no, let's not do that. I really think they had plans to release it initially and then for whatever reason, whether it was manufacturing quantities or just the desire to let the first Zelda – take some time and breathe, because they put a lot of marketing behind Zelda, the first one, and it was a standout game, not just because it was a good game, but also because of the packaging and the presentation and the marketing and everything. So yeah, why don't we talk about the first game and what
it's a good idea.
Yeah, this has been Chip Chat, in case you weren't paying attention. Our new segment.
So, The Legend of Zelda. What was it? Let's not read the notes. That's...
Sure.
Tell me, guys, what was it?
Well, it was a It was a game that was developed alongside Super Mario Brothers that couldn't have been more different than Super Mario Brothers. Mm-hmm. Like, they were made at the exact same time, and they feel like just completely different ideas. And that's like developing Star Wars and Indiana Jones at the same time, too. Like, that's really strange. They came out.
And like, they said originally the character walking around on the screen was Mario. Mm. I mean, because that's just what Nintendo did. Yeah, right. They just sort of like plot Mario
Mr. Video.
Like, yeah, Mr. Video, exactly. And just have him walking around. But the idea, you know, is just starting developing that top-down gameplay first and then trying to figure out later. Mm. Definitely, I mean, when the first Legend of Zelda was released in Japan, it was called an RPG. Like, it says that on there, right? So this was clearly like Miyamoto looking at the emerging genre of the role-playing game and saying, I can do this better.
Yeah, and
by taking out all of the parts of the role-playing game.
Yeah. I wonder if Zelda came like 6, maybe like 8-9 months later, if it would have been a different game, because it came out right before Dragon Quest arrived.
Mm. Yeah.
And Dragon Quest really, I know it took a while for
that to get
pick up, but
different
games. But that really sort of set the design of RPGs, and you see a lot of Dragon Quest in Zelda 2, actually.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like the game came out at just the right time to be what it was and to be sort of unshaped by other trends in the Japanese games industry.
Right. They were both shaped by the growing like realization that RPG is a thing and then took it in two wildly different directions. Like because Dragon Quest also looked at, you know, games like Wizardry and games like Black Onyx and were like, you know, let's make this really for the console audience. Mm. Let's make this for kids. Let's make this for, you know, casual gamers, if you will.
It was also shaped by the hardware too, right? Because it was a Famicom disk system.
Sure, yeah.
It was made for that. It was like, what can we do with this system? Well, we can put saves on it. What does a game that needs saves look like?
Yep.
Doesn't look like Super Mario.
Yeah, because Dragon Quest on cartridge in Japan used passwords. Everything used passwords. And so their idea, being a third party, was, well, we have to use passwords. There's nothing else we can do. But the disk system was there. You know, one of the major like benefits of the Famicom disk system was this will let you save games and have adventures that go on and on and on. You don't have to write down passwords anymore.
Yeah,
and
you
then
said,
the first games that we saw, you know, on Famicom disk system were like Castlevania,
Metroid.
Kid Icarus, Metroid, and these were games that – and Zelda, and these were games
all
that allowed
saves.
You to – they all had saves.
Can you imagine Castlevania having saves? That makes it so possible.
It makes sense why the U.S. version was so, like, completely ridiculously difficult.
Yeah.
The game's
it's
still
fair,
difficult, but saves.
It's so difficult.
Right, right. But you can try the same levels over and over again.
For me, growing up and just kind of figuring out video games, Zelda was kind of like the dad game. Like, everyone's dad was playing Zelda. Like, if you were a dad in the 80s, Zelda was your game, and it was this thing I would watch people's dads play and be like, that looks so complicated, but eventually I got the confidence to play it myself. But for some reason, it was just like, I just viewed it as the dad game. Like, you're a mustache dad in the 80s, you're playing Zelda, having a good time with your aviator glasses.
You know, sentiment so clearly. I can totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I just remember, I felt a little young for Zelda when it came out. Like, I can just say that.
Well, Zelda, I mean, you know, because it was the lengthy adventure that kept drawing you back in, you know, all dads, you know, they would sit down and play some Super Mario Brothers. Maybe dad even beat Super Mario Brothers.
Remember mom's liking Zelda too.
But like
making maps and stuff.
Your parents might try things and then sort of walk away from it. Say, okay, I played that game. That was fun. That was interesting, but I don't really play games. But Zelda was like one of the first games on the NES where it would just keep bringing you back for more because you can't just sit down and play it a little bit.
It's kind of like Infocom text adventures. Like parents always liked, were attracted to those to just come back and they're a little bit more surreal.
Right. And they're slow paced and they reward, you know, they reward the things that parents have the patience and the perspicacity for that maybe kids don't. Like, you know, your parents are good at Zelda because they're doing problem solving and they're going, okay, let me take a step back here. What if I bomb this wall? Whereas kids are just like, ah, killing enemies. I can't play this game. How do I get past this dungeon?
Yeah. It's funny how we're talking about everybody as parents because we were kids then, but actually we're just talking about adults.
That's,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Makes you think.
Perspective. It's a matter of perspective.
Adults own NESs if they didn't have
that's
kids?
That's the thing, right?
That's the question, the chicken and egg.
Kids are the gateway.
You know, it would be like the distribution. You know, some of them would. The weirdos would. And then most
adults
people
had Ataris.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, somewhere along the line. You know, it was the introduction of computers.
But that probably also burned them on, like, I'll just get an adult computer instead of a kid's toy.
No, I mean that's essentially what was happening. Yeah. I mean, remember when the NES came out? Here's something we've done to death on Retronauts. You know, people thought People thought that video game systems were over. And so, if anything, they were trying to sell them as like, as a children's toy, right? But but parents, adults had moved on to computers, and of course, they'd sit on their computers for hours and hours playing games, but they weren't playing video games. These were computer games for grownups.
So I want to go back to the idea of Zelda being an RPG because, man, are people insufferable about arguing that it's not
action,
an RPG?
Action RPG or adventure or...
It's okay. Role-playing game is a very open and broad term. Just because you don't have numbers that go up...
What about the
doesn't
numbers?
Mean it's not an... Oh, you did it.
But
you
I feel so uncomfortable.
You blew it up. But I mean, it really was drawn
from...
You can't
make a character.
It was kind of trying to distill... RPG concepts into sort of an action milieu, if you want to say. You know, you had games like Adventure for Atari 2600. That was in the late 70s. Venture by Exidy. And then on the Japanese side, which probably was more influential to Nintendo, you had Namco's Tower of Juraga, which Zelda looks very, very much like Tower of Juraga.
So like, does Gauntlet.
Suspiciously like Tower of Juraga.
There's
not I'm saying
stairs,
it's a ripoff.
It's got a guy with a very short sword.
Yeah, I mean it's they
top
are
down
very
with
the three
each,
quarters
yeah,
perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like the characters and everything.
Well,
are
you
not
have
top down.
Like those wizards that are just like the wizrobes. They warp around and shoot at you. I mean it's very definitely coming from the same cloth. But you also had on the PC side. You also had Falcom experimenting with series like Sorcerian. And those may not have been quite as directly molded and influential for Nintendo. But that was like 19.
I've never heard of that one.
What's that?
Sorcerian? Is that
Sorcerian dark? Is, it's a PC game. I think they worked on PC 88 mostly.
The problem, I think one of the issues with like if we, one of my problems is if we call Zelda a role-playing game, it almost defines down role-playing game to the point that role-playing game starts to lose a lot of its meaning. And we don't really have a word to describe a Final Fantasy anymore. If that's an RPG,
it's an action RPG.
Then Zelda's
that's
also an
is.
RPG. I mean, I think that's debatable. Like, well, I'm not really passionate about it.
I don't really want to have this argument. I'm just saying that it is attempting to distill RPG concepts into an action experience. So action RPG
is a really
good description for RPG or for what the game is. And you know, I just. Went to the GDC Diablo panel yesterday and listened to David Brevik talk. And, you know, afterwards I asked him, like, you said that Diablo was the birth of the ARPG, but, you know, I was playing action RPGs on consoles a long time before that. So how does that differentiate? And he said, you know, at the time that Diablo came out, there were a lot of PC grognards who were like, God, no, this is not an RPG. Like, where's the character creation system? What the hell? This is no RPG. So there's always people trying to draw boundaries. I'm more interested in looking at the idea, the inspiration behind Zelda, and it really is to take the RPG experience and make it a stabby, fast action game.
And Miyamoto is not into RPGs. I mean, he will say, I think when I was talking to him about, I don't know, Mother or something like that, or Earthbound, it was just like, I dislike RPGs. I have a fundamental dislike of RPGs. Because you don't need to, like, perform well or get better. I mean, you just have to put in the time, like, just pressing the A button over and over again to build up your character before you move on.
So Zelda is the RPG for people who don't like RPGs by the people who don't like RPGs.
Right. That is precisely what it is. It's trying to take that concept and move it forward. Now, Zelda 2, which we'll talk about later, I mean, that, I think you can see, that is a reaction to the popularity of Dragon Quest, because Dragon Quest was explosive in its popularity in Final Fantasy. And so now RPGs being a huge thing in Japan, Nintendo was like, okay, now let's do a game with numbers. Now let's do a game with grinding.
Those games basically play themselves compared to Zelda 2. That game
No, no, no. That was it was an attempt to toe the line. It was an attempt to walk the line.
Yeah, I think to push back toward the RPG, the RPG concept.
Still maintain the action-oriented nature of the gameplay where you do have to perform the game well, and you do have to have skills in order to do that, but to add in grinding and to add in experience and to add in more RPG elements. And then they pulled back from that immediately, and then they never did that again.
It's funny you mentioned all the Japanese influences, because I don't know a lot of those except for Black Onyx, but like so many of the games that you see mentioned are American games that even came out for the Famicom.
Well, it's very a lot of early movement
come out of America.
Yeah, a lot of the earliest Japanese RPGs, really before Zelda, Dragon Quest, you know, 1986, they weren't coming out on consoles because consoles couldn't support them. Like we said, you know, you really need to be able to save your data. So those were coming out on Japanese PCs, and that is a mystery area that is very inaccessible for Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that really just deserves someone to devote a whole lot of time, maybe a career, to unearthing. But, you know, we get little bits and pieces. Like, new information is always coming out. Like, someone stumbles across some PC 88 game or some game for the Sharp X1 and is like, whoa, this is mind-blowing. Can you believe this? Like, it's just so hard to find information on that. Even if you read Japanese, there's not necessarily a lot of information online. It's just like, you know, in America, there were all these PC games coming out, and we know about the big ones, but what about all the little ones that were distributed and in, you know, Ziploc bags, and, you know, 20 copies were made and stuck on a store shelf somewhere? Yeah, like, it's just such a mysterious area, such an undocumented area. So I think Falcom, you know, Sorcerian and Xanadu and some of those other games that they did, like 1984, 85, before Zelda, those are well-known just because Falcom continued to thrive and continued to grow and continued to build on those series. Like, Sorcerian had sequels. Xanadu continued to have sequels. There was a Fazanadu for Nintendo Entertainment System.
Are those related?
Yeah, they are. It's Famicom Xanadu. There you go.
I think it's really funny to look at the dungeons of Zelda and see Tower of Draga in them and know that that's where they started with Zelda. Like, the dungeons were where they started. And there was even a dungeon creation tool that was considered. And the overworld came second. But when I just picture Zelda, it's all overworld to me. I mean, the dungeons are big, but it started as a dungeon crawler.
I remember,
but the overworld is what's significant about Zelda for me.
I remember being excited to play Tower of Draga finally, like in the late 90s when it came out for the Namco collection. And I sat down to play, and I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, what do I do? Where do I go? And I think you really needed to be part of that arcade culture in Japan in the 80s there was a conversation being had. It's kind of like Dark Souls today without the internet. Well, I'm sorry for the Dark Souls.
I don't even. It really is. I mean, you had to input button codes that you had just no idea what they were until somebody figured it out by accident.
It was even more arcane than Dark Souls.
Yeah, my understanding is that Tower of Draga did pretty well in the arcades, but it was 100 yen a play, so that's not cheap. And it really exploded in popularity once it came out on Famicom. Which was like 1984, 85.
It was such a good deal.
I think early 85.
That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was going to save you money, but you know, like that, it was one of the early first party or third party releases, and there weren't a lot of Famicom games at that point. It was kind of early on in the life cycle, so a lot of people bought that game. A lot of kids, you know, and then they started doing the sharing and the information and buying strategy guides because there was a strategy guide explosion in 1985, 1986. So it did become kind of this you know, this sort of trendy thing, and I really feel like that helped shape the Legend of Zelda because Tower of Draga did have such a huge presence among Famicom owners at the time.
Yeah, strategy guides, to your point, would chart on Japanese bestseller lists. Like, they were some of the most popular books.
And we saw a little bit that with like How to Win at Pac-Man, but it was so isolated.
Right.
Whereas there, it was just, you know, when Japan does something, it goes all in. It's not like here in America where we're just kind of like, nah. Like, they do it, and then they drop it.
Tower of Draga is built on Pac-Man hardware. Like, by 1984, they're still using a Pac-Man board with different ROM sets. That's your basis for an RPG.
So Pac-Man is where it all begins.
Yeah, everything goes back to Pac-Man.
But yeah, The Legend of Zelda kind of stepped away from the RPG by making, you know, it took out experience points, and in doing so, it divorced character advancement from the idea of killing and of defeating enemies. Like, enemies were there, but they were kind of a means to an end. Like, you would kill them to get rupees or, you know, to restore some health, or just, you know, in the dungeon to clear out all the enemies in a room so that you could find its secrets. But it wasn't really the point to go out and like say, I'm going to become stronger by killing bad guys. You just had to kill the bosses, basically. Like, you can make it through Zelda with killing very few enemies. Instead, the idea was that character advancement became sort of a corollary to the things you discovered throughout the game, the tools you found. And that kind of became really sort of an ongoing theme in a lot of Nintendo's more adventurous games. Metroid is the same way. You advance through the world, and learn to or to gain the ability to uncover new areas and advance to new places by discovering tools, and those become sort of an integral part of your tool set. So they weren't really big on the idea of, you know, abstract numbers making you stronger. It was much more concrete, like your health is going to go up because you found this gym that, you know, gives you an extra heart for your life meter. That is how you get stronger. You find these things, you discover, you explore, you poke in every corner of the world. And you're right, Zelda started as a dungeon crawler, but the dungeons to me were always really the easiest part of the game. I mean, you might have to take a few attempts at them, but
it
was
the overworld. You need a subscription to Nintendo
Power. it was really the overworld that was so complicated because it was just, you know, like this, 16x8 grid. So what is that, 128 different screens? And I think 90-something of them have a hidden secret on them. So you don't know what those secrets are going to be. They could be pushing an object. They could be burning something, blowing a flute at the right time. There's no way to know until you just try
things.
No,
it's only those three things.
It is those three things, yeah. But that's still three different things to do and a whole lot of bushes to burn.
Right.
I think it was more manageable than Draga, though, because there were far fewer variables to work with. Like, you could always – you can always kind of brute force it with Draga, like you guys were saying. Like, sometimes it was secret codes or you have to step on the right square or whatever. It just is really arcane stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Draga was inscrutable by design, and that was really how games of that era tended to extend playtime. They just made things impenetrable. And Zelda does a little bit of that.
Oh, for sure.
I think it's hard for people to go into that game for the first time these days because it does require you to burn every bush and bomb every wall and push every statue or whatever.
The beauty, though, is that you can go out and just – the overworld is so open that you can go out and see everything.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you know what to do with it or not, that means that later when you figure out what to do with it, you can go back to all those things that you spotted before and put connections together. That's just the most exciting part of exploration for me and something the Zelda series just hasn't had since that game. I mean, it has a little bit in Link to the Past. It's just the ability to probe the farthest corner of the map and come back. That's what Skyrim does now, not Zelda. And it's risky to go to the corner of the map. There's centaurs there, and they'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but that's not an invisible wall that's stopping you. It's not a corridor that's preventing you from going through a gate.
No, it's a sword beam that takes off 2/3 of your life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can quickly walk around them.
If you're very good. So we mentioned the Famicom Disk System earlier, but why don't we go into a little more depth about that? Like you said, Sam, Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda were pretty much developed in parallel, and Nintendo knew the Famicom Disk System was coming out. For those who don't know at home, why are you listening to the show, or how did you find the show, I guess? The Famicom Disk System was a peripheral released only in Japan for the Japanese version of the NES, and it was a 3-inch diskette drive, and it did exactly what it sounds like. Games came on discs, and you popped them in, and they'd word to life and load, and you could save on them. And the hardware did add a little bit of extra capabilities to the system. At the time, the diskettes had more storage capacity than cartridges. And secondly, thanks to the kind of the way the Famicom hardware was designed, there was an expansion port inside the cartridge slot, and the Famicom connected through the cartridge slot and enabled an extra sound channel. So the hardware sound channel went from 4 to 5.
Right.
And
the demise of the Famicom Disk System was hastened by the fact that cartridges quickly overtook the amount of storage that was on a disk, which was fixed. You could not have a bigger disk. And then also they could then add in those sort of kind of enhancement chips to the cartridges as well, which, again, you could not enhance the Famicom disks. And so it burned so bright in Japan for like a year or two and then was gone forever.
The rewritability of those disks is so integral. I mean, imagine a place where you can't rent games. You could take a disk to a place and get for 500 yen a new game put the disc.
Yeah.
The value proposition was great. The $30 to $50 game.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't like today where you download a copy of Zelda and it costs the exact same amount as retail or possibly more because they don't put it on sale.
Mm-hmm. And there are some games for the Famicom disc system today that are super rare because you have to
find it on someone's disc.
Yeah, they were only writable copies. You had to go to a store and have a disc rewritten or just buy a new disc and have it written with this game. Ugh. You couldn't just go to a retail store and buy the game. It had to be written with the disc writer onto a disc.
Like Final Square games were all like that.
I finally got my last Square Famicom disc system
game. The pinball game?
The pinball game. Yeah. Moonball Magic. Finally got one.
Never heard of
it?
Yeah. Haven't played it yet, but I can because I have a working
disc. Is it a dog game?
It is. They're all dogs.
Okay.
Now, people figured out at the time how to copy discs illegally. Okay. And that's so why it didn't come to America.
Like, piracy also hastened the demise.
Yeah,
it didn't need to come to America.
By the time they would have brought it to America, it was already on the decline in Japan.
Okay,
they kind of
realized
like, oh yeah, okay. And they realized like, oh, this is just not worth it. So, how do you bring? So, but of course, in 1986, 1987, some of the biggest games that we remember as the classic NES games were actually Famicom disc system games. Mm-hmm. So, how do you bring a disc game over to America?
Well, for Castlevania, you just take out the save states.
Yeah, exactly.
Just compromise it and make them play it in one place.
Sometimes we get the harder version of games. Everybody always thinks, oh, they make games easier for U.S. audiences.
Sometimes they make them way harder. Yes, the Castlevania use what is known in the trades as the fuck you method, which is we're just taking out the save feature. Deal with it.
Still a great game, though. We didn't know any better.
Right. Metroid and Kid Icarus, which, of course, not a coincidence. They were both released with that cool silver box, password series.
Password pack.
Games. They reprogrammed them to use passwords. Now, they also, I will say, nicely took advantage of the fact you can do different things with passwords versus saves. Because when you have a password, you can then put in secret passwords.
Yeah.
Which they did with both Metroid and Kid Icarus. There were secret passwords.
Danger, Terror, Horror.
Danger, Terror, Horror. Icarus fights Medusa Angels. Yeah. And of course, Justin Bailey. Right.
But were those like put in there for players or were they more like debug
testers.
Codes? Kind of like the Konami code was originally put in because the guy who was testing Gradius and programmed the NES version was like, I can't beat this game.
Justin Bailey is not helpful for any sort of debugging whatsoever.
I think that's just that's pretty much been figured out to be just a random string that, yes, it turns out that it seems like it means something.
You're kidding me.
No, get out.
What does it mean?
There's
all these theories, like Bailey's a swimming suit, right. Like Justin Bailey.
Or somebody's name or whatever, but like, why would Samus be running around without her power suit on?
And with green hair.
Yeah.
What about the green hair?
So we need the green hair? That means she's got the Varia.
But she doesn't run around without the suit on in the game normally, right?
Yeah. That's unusual. It's unusual not to have the Varia suit, but not have your helmet.
Yeah, I've done it once.
Oh, you can do it.
Yeah, you can beat the game without the Varia, and Samus is naturally a brunette.
I think Justin Bailey...
That means green, right?
Yes, that's Spanish for green.
I think Justin Bailey, Chris Houlihan, and Andy Kaufman are all living together in the same trailer park somewhere, and we can't find them.
Didn't Andy Kaufman program Polybius?
What?
Yeah.
Resulting
in death.
Debug menus, like if you go to a debug menu and it allows you to select your stage and change variables, like that's a debug menu. Like something that just jumps you to the end of the game, fully powered up. It's like, that's not particularly helpful.
Well, we know in Kid Icarus, there's definitely codes that were made for fun.
Yeah.
I don't know for Metroid necessarily, but
it's like jumping to Mike Tyson,
the code to jump to Mike Tyson with a bad record, basically, right? Because that one was for fun. It was to circulate it out there so people can, do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there is the NARPA sword password for Metroid, which people are pretty sure is, for debugging purposes or testing purposes.
Yeah.
Because it could either mean like NAR, like password. Someone said it's North American release, password.
Yeah.
I think the programmer or tester was named Narahito or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it could be like Hito's password.
Right.
Who knows?
Nara's password.
So, yeah. But no one really knows, but it's all kind of, just speculation.
Mm-hmm. So the disk system had immediate advantages, but it also had a big disadvantage, and that was load times. We never got load times on NES cartridges, but the Famicom, Zelda itself has big black screens when you go into the dungeons.
I will say that having just played through a bit of Zelda on Famicom Disk System and also Metroid and a few other games, a well-programmed game is not super terrible about load times. It's not like, reading for example, from a personal remembrance here, you know, playing Atom games, Coleco Atom games off a cassette tape, mm-hmm. where it would take like 2 minutes to load a stage.
Well, Famicom cassette system would have been a little slower.
There was a cassette system, really? But it wasn't used for games.
Right. Oh, okay. What was it used for?
It was used for making your own games and then saving that data.
Yeah.
Just rewritable.
If you need a lot of data.
Or also saving your Excitebike stages or
Wrecking
Crew.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
We got robbed.
Yep.
We did. Anyway. By ROB.
Yeah,
and then
so
Well, Zelda was the third method because they decided that they didn't want to just, A, make people play from the beginning of Zelda all the time, but also that, B, it was maybe just too complicated to rely on a password system. This is a game that's going to take you a long time to play. You didn't want to be constantly re-entering passwords. Mm-hmm. So they had to come up with a technological innovation that had not actually been used anywhere at that time.
I think it's used in pinball machines.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah, that's how high scores are saved. Okay. I put them in before. It's an SRAM chip and then a battery.
Okay.
And that just goes to one pin of it. And I've never cracked open a Zelda cartridge, but I've fixed a lot of pinball machines that have that exact thing in them.
Yeah, okay. It's basically
so they moved
just
it
like
over
this,
from pinball machines.
Yeah, like a very low amount of voltage. It's just constantly mm-hmm. being fed into the SRAM.
3 volts.
And those last forever. Like, there's still Zelda cartridges that still work. They were supposed to last for
five
years.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
30 years later. Nope, still going.
Yeah, my Earthbound one still works.
Yeah.
I have to wonder,
that
though.
That might be different. That might actually have
It might be a more advanced model.
There's also a chip to store memory later that doesn't need voltage.
Super Nintendo was all batteries.
It is batteries, too?
Okay.
I want to crack one of those open, but it's worth too much.
Game Boy Advance, you have ones that don't use battery. Mm-hmm. But Super Nintendo, I think, was all still battery.
You can retroactively go back to your cartridges now and put in non-volatile storage, which is basically not battery, if you want.
I have to wonder, though, were Kid Icarus and Metroid released 1 year before Zelda in the States? Were they both 1 year before?
I think
they were released. They were actually released around the same time.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that the packaging is from that earlier. Metroid and Zelda were released weeks apart.
Okay, I was wondering if the password system was so bad they were just getting a lot of feedback from like their customer support.
No.
Like, they won't take my password because there's zeros and O's and
well,
ones.
They got
and
that
and
feedback
O's.
About batteries because the batteries wiped all the time.
Mm.
Oh yeah,
and there's iterations of Zelda in the United States where some of them warn you to hold reset and some of them don't.
Oh, wow, right.
Yeah, no,
I never even realized that.
I really think, you know, Zelda was meant to be this sort of standout game. They gave it the golden cartridge and a golden box that just had a crest on the front. It broke from the black box style. Even the silver password games still used the sort of standard NES box art, first party box art format. It was just with silver instead of black. But Zelda was different, and I really think that, you know, putting the battery in there was a big part of that. It made the experience a lot more pleasant. For people.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the Metroid passwords were a big enough pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But Zelda, you really needed to just be able to jump in and get back to where you were going. And, you know, it lent itself to that. I remember going to a friend's house and playing around on his Zelda cartridge, and I saw that there was a save file that had 3 hearts and 256 deaths. Like, there's a death counter on the title screen. It shows how many times you've died and restarted. And I was like, who is this? And he was like, oh, that's my sister's save file. The punchline is that his sister is in high school, not just some like little kid. she just didn't know how to play the game, but she kept playing and kept trying. And, you know, I'm sure she would not have gotten that far into the game, that many attempts and deaths, if she had to input a password every time she wanted to start up a new session of the game.
Yep.
So it really did lend itself to just people kind of casually jumping in, mucking around a little bit, seeing what they could find, dying, saving, calling it a day.
I do really like the Japanese cover art, but you are right that the American cover art is so much more iconic. It really stands out. And as a kid, like putting in the gold cartridge or like just looking at it, marveling at it, was an experience. Like, oh my gosh, it's like a special game. You know,
it
really was like designed to be like, this is very unique and important.
And when you don't grow up in Japan, you don't realize that all the cartridges there were beautiful colors.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all amazing.
Now I know it's like a rainbow of plastics.
Yeah. And here there was a patent on that gray cart, so it was a risk to make a gold one. I mean, they didn't make any other colors because of the gray cart look was like this level of protection, legal protection for their games. That's why Tengen had to make those crappy-looking
black
cartridges. Or Color Dreams made the blue ones.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, in Japan, third parties could manufacture their own cartridges, at least in, you know, initially. Yeah.
And man, you got a whole swath.
They made some
of
crazy
them.
Looking cartridges. Like Konami was pretty normal looking, except there's always a hole in the cartridge. Like in the upper left hand corner, there's this hole. I guess you could put your cartridge on a keychain or something. Cool. I don't know.
I hear there's ones with LED beacons
I think,
on the top of them.
Is it Sunsoft or IREM?
Jalico?
Oh, Jalico? No, I don't think it's Jalico. It might be IREM.
Like City Connection.
Maybe IREM?
I think so.
Okay. Maybe it's Metal Storm.
But yeah, they would put LEDs in. Yeah.
For the amount that Metal Storm sells for in Japan, I would not just want LEDs. I would want like a small light show that just like
lasers
illuminates
and smoke.
My house.
Maybe
a Pink Floyd light show.
Shaped like the Mecha.
I don't know. I've never seen inside.
Yeah.
But yeah. So Zelda was unique because it was the first NES cartridge to come in something other than a gray, pretend this is a VHS tape case.
And the second to last licensed one. There aren't any others. There's just Link.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was thinking of Super NES cartridges. Unlicensed. There were a few colored Super NES cards. But
Yeah, that was what. Okay, never mind. I was going to say, I wasn't Linked to the Past Gold. Maximum Carnage was red. If they could pull out the stops,
that was
that
a big
game,
disappointment. Totally. When I opened that game box and was like, wait a minute.
It's
boring. What about
Where's
a lenticular?
My gold?
Which one had lenticular? Was that Majora's Mask? Majora, I think.
Yeah.
Well, Ocarina of Time 2 didn't it?
I don't think so. I think it was just gold. Majora. And they were all gold for Majora. Some people are like, I got the gold Majora. It's like, no, I'm sorry. They're all like that.
Now, do they all have the lenticular, though?
I think they all have the lenticular. I'm not sure if there was a second printing.
No rarity.
The gray Majora.
Oh, on the cart. On the cart, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Well, there's a demo gray card.
Right, exactly,
So send us those cheap ones.
Yeah,
gray cards. We'll send you gold ones.
Send you gold for gray, yep.
So yeah, Zelda took about a year longer to come out in the U.S. than its initial Japanese release, partly because, you know, it came out in Japan before the NES had actually entered the national broad market here. But also, I think they needed time to get a cartridge that big and to figure out how to do the save RAM and everything like that.
Yeah, they had to make new hardware for it. They certainly didn't spend that time in localization.
No.
I mean, there's serious localization problems with both that and Zelda 2. For being the flagship titles,
there's bad
clues in those games.
Zelda, there's localization problems. This is one of the first games to get localized.
Yeah.
This was
Before
one of
that,
the
it
first
was,
games
yeah.
to well, get localized.
I mean, every arcade game was localized.
Well,
and they have problems, too.
If you read Legends of Localization, and everyone should, the Zelda localization book, you will realize like how do we even know what we were doing? Like everything is wrong.
Since you're bringing it up, this is a great time to plug the book Legends of Localization by Clyde Mandolin, who translated Mother 3 and is actually a professional translator. And he had the website, right? I mean, where a lot of this information appeared. But man, in book form, which is beautiful, it's by Fangamer, it's gorgeous. I loved reading through it in the book because not only do you find out about like every different way the games were changed between Japan and the U.S., but like you learn about every different aspect of The Legend of Zelda because like in showing how it's changed, he has to explain what it was originally. If you are at all interested in going deep on Legend of Zelda, like this book is phenomenal. It's full color, really. There is some stuff in there like the enemy like where that name came from. I could not even believe it when I read it because I'm like, I cannot believe that I have gone my whole life without knowing this because that is deep. It's deep.
Like a really obscure bug and error from that.
It's a pun. It's something about it's something about water bugs and what they like.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like the pun is on, I forget what it is, but it's like Tate is shield.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's all about
go
how
buy the book.
It's all about how it eats shields
we really need
versus eating bugs. And
we really should be getting a commission on all the times we've pimped that book.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I'm
looking forward to my
pimping
check.
The book. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, check out the Retronauts Pocket that I interviewed Clyde on and Heidi Mandolin.
There you go.
Yep.
Zelda is really interesting in terms of game design because I think, as you mentioned, Sam, it's really open. Like, you can go to almost any screen on the overworld from the very outset of the game. If you know the way through the Lost Woods in the southwest corner of the map, you can pretty much go to any place that you don't need a raft or a ladder to get to, which is like three screens. Mm-hmm. You can go anywhere. You'll probably die once you get up into Death Mountain or the graveyard.
But you could go there.
But you could go there in theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are game like game runs that are kind of built around the idea of seeing how far you can get without picking up the sword. And you have to, like, go find a place to get free money and then go buy some bombs. And yeah, it's really like the game lends itself to that kind of like crazy, like, how can I play this? How can I play this game in ways that the designers never intended?
And there is an appeal to this if you can pull it off in your video game. Like, for example, like, okay, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out comes out. Nintendo immediately distributes the code that warps you right to Mike Tyson. Well, doesn't that ruin the game? No, because if you've never played the game before,
you can't possibly beat him even if
you're going to warp directly to Mike Tyson. He's going to completely destroy you. And not only that, now it's really set up this whole game as like, oh my God, how will I ever beat Mike Tyson? He's too powerful. But then if you go through the entire game, by the end of it, you actually have the skills to beat him, and it feels like a real accomplishment. So setting it up at the beginning by having him destroy you, that was a really clever way of doing some like out of order kind of narrative, you know, player story stuff with that game. Zelda, very similar. Yeah, go to Death Mountain. Go to Death Mountain and get wrecked. Yeah, in that case, it's about collecting
it's so
heart
much,
containers.
It's so much, and this ties exactly into what you two were talking about earlier about gameplay being the RPG element in this and how it being so important. Because in Final Fantasy, you'd handle that by having a boss character cream your team right at the beginning without you, but you're still playing, and then you're like, well, how am I ever going to beat that guy? Well, it's just a
Final
series
Fantasy
of button
II
presses
does that.
Mm-hmm. And grinding to get to there. But in this game, you actually have to do the same thing. You have to grind for a while and get better, but it also you're actually going to be physically better at the game by that point and not just choosing healing spells in a better way.
Yeah, you'll figure out, oh, I can, you know, get the right kind of shield and I can deflect those Lionel's sword beams and, you know, I can shoot them from across the screen and not have to get up close and so on and so forth.
Or you still run around the centaurs, though. Don't go for those guys. Just run. Just avoid them.
It's fun to kill them. anyway, so, yeah, if you sit down and really look at what gating exists in the game, you need 8 Triforce pieces. In other words, you need to beat all of the first 8 dungeons to enter Death Mountain, the final dungeon. To beat Ganon, the final boss, you need the Silver Arrow, which is inside the final dungeon. You need a few items to uncover certain dungeons. Like, there's one dungeon you can only find by burning a bush, so you need the candle for that. There's one dungeon you can only reach by taking a raft, so you need the raft to get there. And there's one dungeon that you can only reveal by blowing a flute on a certain screen to reveal a secret. So that's,
is there a clue for that one?
There are secrets where fairies don't live. Go. Good luck figuring so that
most,
one out on your health.
Yeah. Most screens, like, in other words.
I lost the second game. I lost my mirror.
What? Zelda was clearly like, I mean, it was, you know, we don't know who translated it, but it was clearly translated by people who with a sort of a bare grasp of English and an English language.
I'm sure it was localized in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe even by Mr. Right. Miyamoto, who knows English pretty well.
The problem with that is that what was probably happening was that these cartridges were literally being mailed back and forth between Nintendo of America and NCL. And Nintendo
I'm
of
sure
America
they were just
would probably
code.
Just be like, yeah, maybe. You know, but they were just like, okay. Nintendo of America probably had to pick its battles as far as what it asked NCL to rewrite and how it asked them to rewrite it.
Yeah.
So they may not really have put that much thought into it. Like, this is, you
right.
know, good
yeah.
enough. And it's pretty clear that the manual was localized in the U.S. Like,
oh,
it was
yeah.
written by the American team. You know,
yep.
Nintendo had a small but very good marketing team, you know, Gail Tilden and Howard Phillips and so forth. And I think it's pretty clear that they, you know, took the Japanese materials and really wrote that themselves. But
right.
localizing inside the game is a more complicated process, and you need someone to program that stuff into the
right.
game.
Which they did not have
it's
in pre-Treehouse
America.
Right?
Yeah, I'm sure they offered some
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
They probably offered some input, but for the most part, I think it was handled in Japan.
That opening Star Wars-like text role is so just awful and great. I love it. Just like quotes are
Friends
around things
darkness,
for no reasons.
Yeah.
Right. Well, they use quotes in Japanese to set off important terms. So they
Which
just carry that over.
Evidence of it not being actually
right,
localized.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Anyway,
oh, I bet the house that it was localized in Japan.
That's
right.
Really
yeah.
Interesting.
Okay.
I never thought about it that way, actually, which is makes so much sense.
Yeah. So that really is kind of a like an unusual sort of game for Nintendo. It's much more of a sort of playground, like a, you know, if you want to say sandbox, sure, it's kind of a sandbox game for you to mess around in. So it really kind of established a new level of depth and substance for NES games and really for console games, because they're, you know, the consoles just didn't have the power, the capability to present that kind of experience before that. So it was something new and interesting.
Well, having read I Am Error semi-recently, I recommend everyone else read that.
Yeah,
we're also promoting other people's books too. Mm-hmm. It's just like that game could not have happened without the programming wizardry that put it all together, and the fact that like all of the dungeons fit together on one big map. They're like just like all parts of one big map. So when you're playing a dungeon, you're just entering that map with all the dungeons, but it's choosing where you are in that matrix of dungeons. It's just mm-hmm. such
and
a marvel.
It's the same size as the overworld.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's 256 screens overall.
And as lots of people know, that was actually half the space was used for one set of dungeons by accident. I believe there's a lot of
ass. Right, right, that's right. It's like, oh, let's put another game in here while we're at it.
There's a mistake. They fit all the dungeons into half the memory by accident. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, why don't you use the second half of that memory to double the size of eight more dungeons. And that's what the second quest is. Mm. And man, that second quest is a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
I still, like, that is such a great thing to explore. For future Zelda-like games, because mm-hmm. there's so much to do it. And now they're re-releasing Twilight Princess and Wind Waker and stuff like that with a kind of second questy elements, but they're not that great. They're always like, lose all your hearts faster.
Or it's like it's a mirror of the world, really. That's as far as they go sometimes.
So we've talked quite a bit about The Legend of Zelda, pretty much covered most of the things that I had in my notes. So just to kind of wrap up the first game, I'm curious to know kind of what your own experiences and memories of the game are. You know, for me, it was the first Nintendo game I remember seeing advertised. Like, I knew about the NES, and I wanted the NES because obviously I was, you know, a kid, and I'd seen demos, and my friends had one. But I'd never really seen anything about it on television, at least not that I can remember. But then those commercials came out, and they made it look so amazing. It was a never-ending adventure. How could I play a game that never ended? Like, how amazing would that be? What if that was the last game I ever needed to play? Like, how cool was that? It was gold. It was special. There was a guy rapping. Like, amazing. I had to have that.
I don't remember how we got it. We got our NES in 1988, so Zelda was already out. It was, you know, one of many games. We might have gotten it used at a flea market or something like that. But I can certainly tell you this. I was really into it, but at the time, I did not play the video games. My brother actually played all of the Nintendo. I mean, like, I played the games, but I was bad at them. He was very good at them, and I was very happy to simply watch him play the games. So he played Zelda. We beat Zelda. I got a strategy guide, and I think he beat Zelda, but we were both very much sort of like cooperatively. I had the guide. I told him where to go. So that was how we played Zelda 1. I don't think I have – no. I have never beaten Zelda 1. I've played a lot of Zelda 1, but I've never finished Zelda 1.
I love finding complete copies of Zelda 1 and seeing somebody's handwriting or maps or whatever they make in there. And sometimes it's clearly their parents that helped them.
Sure.
Just like a really nicely done one with like kids writing all around it. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of my favorite things. And Zelda was the game where I always saw that happening. So I always knew it was probably like this big family game, as Bob was talking about.
Yeah, it shipped with this big fold-out map that showed most of but not all of the overworld. The kind of the corners of the map where things were most difficult and most obscure were left just blank white squares. And they didn't show where any of the hidden secrets in any of the screens were. So it was there for you to, you know, like say, well, this is where I can bomb and find a heart container. Or up over here, there's, you know, the money-making game or a hidden, you know, hidden rupees or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of left like that. That map begged to be marked on. It was not meant to be pristine. If you have a pristine copy of the Legend of Zelda map and it was used, that means someone who owned it before you was horrible and had no soul. Like, they didn't understand the passion about this game. Like, they just didn't get it.
I probed Zelda a bit when I was a kid. I never rented it, but friends had it. But I never got into it, and I forced myself to play all the way through it. Very much enjoyed it when I already knew you guys. So I did this. I think Brian Altano every day at IGN would say, Now, today you should go for this heart because it's really easy to get. He just helped me through the game. He was my personal
Your
game
life
help.
Coach.
Mm. It was really fun, and for some reason when I was a kid, I was very anti-Zelda. I love Super Mario Brothers. Mm. I love Castlevania. I love Mega Man. But my friends that all like Zelda, it's like, ah, that's just not for me. I can't explain it. I was eight. I was seven.
No,
yeah.
I just don't know
what happened.
The presentation and the marketing around Zelda made it feel like it was a game that was too good for me. Like, I wasn't worthy of this game. Like, it was something that other people could own, but, like, I couldn't have a game like that. That was just too good. And that attitude about, like, RPG-style games stuck with me for a long time. I always looked at those sort of RPG adventure-type games, you know, everything from Zelda to Final Fantasy, as being, like, games for other people. Like, other people own those, and I borrow them.
Felt the same way, Jeremy. That's really interesting.
But, like, mm-hmm. I don't deserve this game. It's too good. I got over it.
Or maybe it was a big kid game or something.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, Final Fantasy
broke me.
I was
a big kid at the time.
So
you know,
into Final
I'm older than, I think, all of you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, I was a teenager at that point. Mm-hmm. Young teen, but still. I don't know what it was. It was just, like, I don't know, sense of lack of
Were
self-worth.
Were you anti-fantasy at all?
I'm not a big fan of fantasy genres.
Because I loved Lord of the Rings, but I always felt like Zelda and things that weren't Lord of the Rings were a knockoff.
Hmm.
I still kind of feel that way. I think other fantasy that's not Lord of the Rings that still has giants and dwarves and stuff in it, I think it's just like, why, like, make up, like, fantasy is so wide. Why use those Tolkien classics?
Oh, we'll have fun talking about Final Fantasy. Don't you worry.
I never actually owned Zelda because it was one of those games where, like, everyone had it, so I didn't feel the need to buy it, like Mario 3. And again,
it's ubiquitous.
Yeah. Again, it was the dad game, and I inherited it from my stepdad when he married my mom. And I got to a certain point, but I never finished it, but it was just fun to play in the world and just, you know, how many rupees can I get? Where can I explore, even if I wasn't finishing the game? It wasn't until I actually finished A Link to the Past a few years later that I think I was ready for what Zelda was asking of me. And I didn't actually finish it until after I beat Link to the Past. So it's been a while, but I have finished the game before.
Yeah, I never owned Zelda until many, many years later, but I borrowed it from friends and, you know, played all the way through it over the course of a couple of weeks and got hints and everything like that, but really kind of figured it out on my own. And I remember the sense of elation I had when I defeated Ganon for the first time and then discovered, oh, there's a second quest. I should try this out. Then I ended up beating the second quest in like a weekend because I knew pretty much all the tricks. Like, the only thing the second quest adds is much greater difficulty and the new element where you have to push against walls to walk through them. And I think there was a tip in Nintendo Power, like,
there
are certain walls you have to push through. So I knew to do
but
that.
But don't you also have to, like, burn a different random bush a lot?
Oh, yeah. Everything is changed around.
So you just go through the perimeter of every level.
Very difficult, to find, right? Yeah. Like, the entrance to the dungeons is
But
like,
you know the trick, which is to test every single tile.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
That's not exactly fun.
No, but it went much faster the second quest through.
Yeah.
Anyway, so final thoughts about the first Legend of Zelda.
It truly is a legend.
Zelda needs to go back to that. They need to go back to – I would love a big exploration-based game that's risky. I just love that idea.
What they seem to be promising, at least. Yeah. We'll see if they follow
through.
It's been a while.
We'll see about that.
Yeah. They say a lot of things every time.
Yep.
I might be the only person.
And then you find yourself, you know, collecting
notes,
five
music notes,
musical notes to get the freaking boomerang again.
Yeah, I might be the only person in the world who found A Link to the Past somewhat disappointing because it did go back toward, you know, the original Zelda style from Zelda 2, which I thought was cool. But it just didn't have that sense of, like, everything is open. It felt much more structured and rigid. And I really liked that. That's what addicted me to, you know, both Zelda and Metroid. Those were two of the first games that I really got into. And just their openness and the sense of, like, hey, I have to figure this out on my own. I need to just, like, poke my nose into all these corners and figure out how things work. I really liked that kind of sense of, you know, you're just out there on your own, figuring it out. It's you against this entire horrible video game world. And A Link to the Past, you know, really pushed the series more toward puzzle-like dungeons, which are cool. I like the puzzle-like dungeons, but the world itself, the overworld, became more puzzle-like.
It's fences and gates instead of just being a big open field to explore.
And there is satisfaction in, you know, making all those things work, and I think that's more, you know, like, better game design and more deliberate game design and more appealing game design for most people. But I do miss the sense of just, like, here's Zelda. Go figure it out.
You know what, Jeremy, and everybody at home, it's time to drink. I think Dark Souls has replaced Zelda for me, and I'm not just saying this to be Bob Mackie. I'm saying this because there is that spirit of go anywhere. You might get killed, but you also might find something cool. You might run into a boss you haven't seen before. It's just such an open game, and they're not – they have that confidence that the original Legend of Zelda has. Like, we will just set you free, and you can go to wherever you want. There is sort of a kind of a right order, but if you want to go outside of that order, you can also have fun there too. So
I will try it based on that.
Yeah,
nobody's ever sold it to me that way before.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like from software.
I have tried it, I just haven't liked it.
Okay,
so I want to go back and try it.
It is a very different game than Zelda, of course, but I find that confidence and that exploration is something that has been missing from the series, and that go to Dark Souls for that rewarding feeling.
Yeah.
And again, you can drink. It's okay.
Yeah, my liver thanks you for this case of cirrhosis.
Love it.
I apologize, everyone.
There is one other Zelda game that does kind of recapture the openness of the original Zelda.
Wind Waker.
Yeah, to a degree, but that's much more sparse.
Wand of Gamelon.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, he nailed it.
I was going to say Oracle of Seasons.
Oh, yeah?
Oracle of Seasons actually started out as a remake of the first Zelda, and it retains not the same degree of openness, but it's much less linear than other Zelda games, and you can very easily take dungeons out of sequence. It's not nearly so gated.
I didn't realize
And I remember,
that.
Yeah,
I played it a lot.
I beat a couple of the dungeons out of order the first time I played through it. It was like, huh. I can't usually do that in Zelda. That's neat.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's really neat.
Like, to me, the Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons feel like kind of a duology. Oracle of Ages is very much like, you know, the modern day Legend of Zelda. It's very like quest based. You're talking to a lot of people and going on little sub quests for them and doing fetch quests and that sort of thing. Whereas Oracle of Seasons is just like you and the seasons and monsters. Mm. And it's kind of, they're kind of nice bookends. Like, they really show where Zelda had been and where it was going. And, you know, if you haven't played those, they're on Virtual Console for 3DS, so please do. They're really good. They weren't...
Yeah, that's the big shame gap in my Zelda knowledge.
Really?
Ages and Seasons. Yeah.
I like Seasons more just because it does have that kind of retro feel to it.
Yeah.
But they're both really good.
Okay.
So,
and
yeah,
it looks really good. You change the seasons where there's snow and snow piles mm-hmm. over everything. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah. That was really kind of meant to take advantage of Game Boy Color. They were like, oh, it's going to be fall, so everything's orange or red
changes.
Now.
Yeah, I think each tile of the world has four potential states mm-hmm. based on the season. So much can change based mm-hmm. on what season it is. It's really fun. It's really fun to play with that world, I agree.
Yeah, I need to revisit that. I actually haven't played it since it came out for the first time. So that's 15 years, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say I replayed it recently, but the thinking back, I replayed it 9 years ago, so that's not very recent.
Oh, time slipping away. We're going to die. Going to die, Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link.
Boo.
The game that kills everyone because
it
hates you.
I will say, I like all the ideas in this game. The way it punishes you is a very old school way of punishing the player by basically wasting their time. That is my only problem with the game for the most part.
Skipped straight to the meat.
I just want to, I mean, in case anyone was wondering why I don't like the game. And my other problem with the game is that I'm filibustering right now. But my only problem with the game is that other problem is I found that the pacing of how they introduce enemies is very strange, where it's like, first dungeon, here's the hardest thing you'll ever fight in the game, and you'll fight a lot of these. Like the
horse heads?
No, the knights. The knights
Oh,
that
no,
you
not
fight.
Dark Knights. They have a different name in this.
Yeah.
Rebanax.
Anyhow,
I feel like this guy did this little jump slash, You jump a little bit and hit him in the face. Jump a little bit and hit him in the face. And they're hard otherwise. Otherwise, you just have to go up and guess which way you're going to stab them, up or down.
It is such a...
But man, I'm very familiar with
it. It's such a bizarre difficulty spike to me that did not feel right. And I've made so many attempts to get back into this, and I can't do it. And I want someone to patch this game and make it a little nicer.
You know what? You know who did that? Nintendo, because they just updated the ambassador version of it with save states. And save states makes that game
much better.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't realize that because I'd been playing it
without
save states.
They don't ever announce the ambassador stuff. Like, stuff gets changed and you have to go into your 3DS download list, which is, for me, hundreds of games. And, there's one that needs an update.
I played half the game.
Oh, by save states, like, you mean like...
You just get to make a save state and reset from there. So you can go screen by screen and not
lose. Didn't they do that with all the Ambassador games in one big batch?
I think they did, yeah.
God, this is all news to me.
And I didn't ever update it. So I was playing it classic. Okay. And then I got through
that. They didn't just do it. They did it like 5 years ago.
You can also do that on Wii U Virtual Console. Anyway, why don't we talk about Zelda 2?
But I agree that save states in general, save states can actually make a lot of games a lot more fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
You just want experience.
Zelda 2 is definitely one of those.
I don't want to say abuse, but I definitely used save states playing through Earthbound Beginnings on Wii U Virtual Console.
Oh,
it's
you
like,
have
you know
to.
What? I'm just going to save state. Yeah.
Okay, so Zelda 2. Surprisingly launched like 10 months after the first game in Japan.
That's so funny.
Like it's less than a year later. It's crazy that they came out with a sequel that quickly. Nintendo hadn't really done sequels before that. They had Super Mario Bros. 2, which was kind of just like, the ROM hack of Super Mario Brothers, but this was a radically different game,
right?
And I think it's important to note.
I wonder if it was already like kind of in development as something. Probably with Mario, and then they were like,
"Here's the interesting
Mario
thing.
Adventure 2."
Yeah,
here's the interesting thing. You know, the main design team for The Legend of Zelda was Shigeru Miyamoto and Takashi Tezuka, the Mario team.
Quite
the main designer. What's that?
Quite
oh, okay.
Indeed,
the main designers for Zelda 2. Miyamoto produced, but what does that mean? He probably just like looked down beatifically and said, numbers, stats, I don't know, but go ahead.
Yeah.
I'll hold off on the tea table for
now. He did not yet. I think
he said, make
at
it
that
first
point,
person.
I don't think he had the tea table power. Like, I don't think he really had the ability to go in and be
Yamauchi
like,
was still alive.
Can we explain what this tea table reference is to people? I think it might be lost on some people.
Oh, it's fine. It's just an oblique reference.
Gotcha.
The main team behind Zelda 2 was Tadashi Sugiyama, Yoichi Yamada, and Kazunobu Shimizu. And the game that all of these people have in common, the one game they all have in common besides Zelda 2, is Doki Doki Panic, a.k.a. Super Mario Bros. 2.
Ah.
So
it was really the next project from the Doki Doki Panic team.
Yeah. So
gotcha.
Doki Doki Panic didn't start out as a Mario game, but when it came to the U.S., of course, it became Super Mario Bros. 2.
Right.
And it was radically different from the first Super Mario Bros.
Was that after Zelda 2?
Doki Doki Panic came out.
It was
87.
It was 87. They both came out around the same time.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, they're not. Yeah, well, I just think Doki Doki Panic is beautiful compared to Zelda, which is kind of rudimentary.
Zelda 2.
I know.
Yeah.
No, Zelda 2 came out first. Actually, Doki Doki Panic was mid 87. I want to say
they both have characters that lift stuff above their heads.
Zelda 2 was February 87.
They made games real fast in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Real fast.
Yeah. But I don't know. Like, there's probably nothing to it. But I think it's interesting that, you know, Nintendo games developed this weird reputation for the second game never being like the first.
Yeah.
Largely on account of Zelda 2 and Super Mario Bros. 2.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even though Super Mario Bros. 2 wasn't a Super Mario game originally,
right.
Zelda 2 was. Mm-hmm. And so there is, I don't know. Like,
it was a Zelda game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does really change the game. You know, Zelda, The Legend of Zelda is a top view, you know, inspired by Tower of Draga, like three-quarters perspective action game where you move freely in all directions around the screen. Zelda 2 was very much a 2D platformer.
Yeah.
And you ran, you jumped. It had RPG elements, but it was also much more of like an action game that you would have expected to see on NES at the time. And it was kind of arriving around the same time as a lot of other games that were attempting to do that. Like a month or two before Zelda 2 came out, there was a game called Wing of Medulla that came out from Sunsoft, which was, like, if you think Zelda 2 is hard and kind of opaque and oblique and difficult to play, you should try Wing of Medulla because that game is just, like, there's no mercy.
Sounds like you shouldn't try it.
I think it's educational. You start out like completely defenseless, almost like unable to destroy anything. And right away you find a better sword, like halfway through the first level. The levels are all very small. And all of a sudden you can like attack stuff. I don't know. Like it has kind of a magic spell system and everything like that. Shortly
that
after,
very similar.
It's very similar. Hmm. Shortly after Zelda 2 came out in Japan, Rygar came out, which attempted to take that arcade game, which was just, you know, like a Rastan Saga sort of linear
arcade game's nothing.
Hack and slash, and right turned it right. into, you know, this non-linear game with tools and equipment, and there is an experience system. And like a hub world, like an overhead hub world. It kind of combined Zelda and Zelda 2, but, you know, it came out so close after Zelda 2, it obviously wasn't influenced by it. So there was this kind of, I would say, like, just sort of this synergy happening. Like, a lot of people were sort of arriving at the same ideas at the same time. Dragon Quest had come out and had been pretty popular the year before. And, of course, Super Mario Brothers came out in 1985, and that was a massive hit.
Yeah.
So people started to think, what if we put all these things together?
People were starting to think, what is a console game? Mm-hmm. Like, what is a home game? Because they, I mean, you know, everything on the Famicom for the first couple of years was ports of arcade games. And so then you had people just starting to consider in a lot of different ways, like, well, what does it mean when it's not just 100, you know, 100 yen a play? Like, what if it, you know, shouldn't everything be a lengthy adventure? I mean, those are the games that are selling the best in Japan. So let's, you know, let's make Rygar into one.
Even Double Dragon had experience points mm-hmm. on the NES version. Yeah, it's so weird.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because, you know, you had a lot of people kind of taking these arcade experiences and trying to make them deeper for the home console, whereas Zelda 2, they kind of pulled it back. Like, they took it back from the top-down overhead view to something that much more resembled Super Mario Brothers mm-hmm. or, you know, an arcade hack and slash. Link is...
And they gave you the shortest sword possible.
It's a dinky mm-hmm. little sword, mm-hmm. but you...
It's so bad.
Link can attack and defend at two different levels, at two mm-hmm. heights. He can stand and he can crouch. And, you know, as you do that, not only does that determine the level at which you're attacking, but also at which you're defending. And that becomes an important part of the game. But really interestingly, Link loses all of his tools in Zelda 2. All the things that you associate with Zelda, like, you know, the boomerang and the hook shot wasn't around yet. Man, I cannot talk. What the hell? Bombs are taken out. Instead, you get magic spells and you get the experience system and you get sword techniques. So, you know,
tools, but they're passive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you get keys.
Well, you get the candle.
There's like a glove that lets you.
Tunnels.
Yeah, but everything is automatic.
You get a raft, but you can only use it for one strip of water.
Yeah, like all of these things become kind of just keys, basically background elements. And you no longer have active tools. I guess that's a better way to say it.
But the spells are the active tools, and they solve puzzles later in the game. Mm-hmm. But the early ones just give you more defense.
Right. And, let you throw fireballs.
Jump is an important one. Mm-hmm. But, man, you're always managing how much magic you have. It's mm-hmm. it's always a battle between, oh, man, should I die just to refill my magic because I have another life? Because you have lives in that game, which is really strange.
Yep.
The whole game is juggling, like, your time. It's like, do I want to start over from here or here? It's so frustrating to figure that out.
The American version, at least, is friendlier than the Japanese version because...
penalized you with experience.
Yeah, right? There's this weird kind of leveling or the experience system where you can allocate your experience points into three different stats. You have your defense, your life meter, which is kind of the same thing, and your attack power. And
but attack power is so important. Actually, it's magic and life and attack
power. Oh, magic. Okay, that's right. Yeah, magic, life, attack. Okay, that
makes more sense. And you want to go for attack, but attack is worth so much more. So you either can spend a dinky amount on your life bar or hold off and don't die.
Right.
And you can only
upgrade when you hit like a target for a certain level of experience. Like,
but it's always 2,000, 3,000, 9,000.
Yeah.
You have to save up a lot of experience and you lose it all if you die.
If you continue. If you die, it's okay. But if you continue, you lose it all. So anyway.
Grinding.
So you have to kind of balance this out and decide, like, do I want to upgrade now or do I want to go for it? Mm-hmm. But in Japan, the Japanese version, there was this weird kind of quirk where if you leveled one element up ahead of everything else, if you ended the game and restarted, you would lose, like, the attribute you had leveled up the most would be knocked back down to be on the same scale as everything else.
Ouch.
Yeah, it's.
Is that a bug, I think I'm remembering that right.
I don't know if it's a bug, but it's something they changed in the US version, and it makes the US version a lot friendlier. Because basically, in the Japanese version, you have to level up all three traits at the same time. And you don't really have to do that in the US. Like, if you really just want to go all in on magic spells for some reason,
don't do that.
Go for it.
So the thing to do is to go for attack power?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, beat it two days ago for the first time ever. And man, yeah, the life becomes important, but it's so much more expensive to get swords. And there's three grinding areas throughout the game that are kind of well known. Mm. And you just kind of have to sit for a while and do that. Mm. It makes the game possible. Mm. And that game can easily be impossible, not because of anything, but just sheer like enemy meanness. Mm. They're so hard. It's so hard to kill anything until you get your downward thrust.
Right.
Which makes it better. Which is a great move.
Those sword attacks are great. The up thrust is not that great, but the down thrust, like, I feel like that is what inspired DuckTales.
Totally.
Because you
it's the pogo.
It totally is. You stab downward, and if you don't kill it right away, you just bounce off its head and you keep stabbing it. Mm-hmm. And there are certain bosses where you have to do that.
Yeah, you dismount one of the bosses from his horse with that attack.
Mm. Nintendo took that move back with Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze because that's Cranky Kong's move, is the bouncing on his cane.
He has a cane move.
So yeah, Zelda 2.
Hardest part in Zelda 2, besides the final dungeon, which is called the Great Palace, is a series. It's a maze of caves
that leads to the final dungeon.
No, that one just sucks because it's like so many enemies, and before that there's those lizards that throw rocks at your head. I hate that part. This is just right between. There's the first town, the first dungeon, and then second town, and then there's Death Mountain, which is cave entrance.
Each
cave has a long fighting area in it, and there's no way to really build up too much before that except if you grind on lame temple enemies, but it's a maze, and if you get lost you basically die because you just are going to run out of life eventually. And the way to get through this is, back then, trial and error. It's like, go in a cave, choose right or left, go in a cave, choose right or left. It's actually a combination of overworld map and platforming areas. It's so crazy hard.
It is, but once you get through it, do you realize, wait a minute, this little area down here is the entire overworld map of the original Legend of Zelda.
It's so
which is
cute.
A great little reference. Like, I think I played Simon's Quest before this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, because that came out in the US before Zelda 2.
Here's the thing, Jeremy.
So it was just like this great little, these games are starting to reference back to the previous ones. I like this.
You mentioning this reminded me of, we never talked about the story of Zelda and how just crazy the story for Zelda 2 is. It is like the most confusing and needlessly convoluted Zelda story, where it's like there's a Zelda born every so many years, and that's the Zelda that's sleeping is not the Zelda from Zelda. I don't understand it.
The Zelda you rescued is like the current princess, but she was named in honor of a princess who was cursed millennia before, centuries before, I don't know exactly. But basically, like, her brother or something made a deal with an evil wizard and reneged on it. And so the wizard put Zelda under a sleeping spell, and she's been asleep for however long. And every daughter born into the royal family since then has been named Zelda.
Hmm.
And so you are rescuing waking the original Princess Zelda,
who has already been sleeping in this temple. So you don't have to deal with him at all.
Well, you don't have to, except if you die, then too bad, because all the bad guys want to kill Link and use his blood as a sacrifice to resurrect Ganon. Like, it's super dark for Nintendo, which was the Ball Bull sample,
right?
I was going to say, he sounds like Mike Tyson or something.
I think it's Ball Bull. I think it's the same thing, yeah.
But yeah, it's really grim for a Nintendo game, like super dark. When you die, the game over screen is the silhouette of Ganon with glowing eyes in black against a red background, and it says, "Game over, the return of Ganon."
Yeah.
And he does that laugh. Yeah, it's kind of dark.
Kind of so awesome. Though.
Zelda never really went that dark again. It's tried.
Right.
Like, there were some parts in Twilight Princess.
Yeah. I mean, it's the black sheep of the series in so many ways.
It is.
In many, many ways.
So to finish that.
It is an entire Zelda made up of ideas that they would never use again.
But that's not entirely true. Is we'll talk about that later.
True? Okay,
not entirely true.
So there's some things.
There's
Zelda
a lot
2.
Of Zelda 2 in Ocarina of Time.
Well, yeah. Indeed. Oh, indeed.
Yeah. I don't think it's a coincidence because the director of Zelda 2 was the
director.
No.
To Zelda.
Like
no.
Game concepts.
Oh, interesting.
Game
okay.
concepts.
Well, I'll let you talk about that
okay.
later.
Okay, we can talk about that later.
I was going to say, so when you die in Zelda 2, the most frustrating thing is that you get sent back to where the princess is sleeping.
Yes.
Right? Like, you lose two lives, and you go back there. You have two lives again to play with after that.
Yeah, that, so, dun, 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 like, that's a trigger.
Yeah. When you get sent back, it's terrible. So imagine coming out the other side of that Death Mountain maze. It's all overworld. You know, you've been playing for a long time, probably like over a half an hour, 45 minutes at that point. And you finally figure out, you get the other side, and there's still random monsters on the map. Remember, random monsters are in this game. They maraud. And if you don't get the hammer at that point, which you will restart with, which is really nice, you will not have a shortcut back to that area. So potentially, if you don't even figure out how to get the hammer, which is also possible because it's pretty obscure, then you are playing the game linearly to get everywhere, and you're playing through this huge bound of gameplay. But the hammer gives you a shortcut right in the middle of the whole world
yep.
that allows you to go in four different directions, and it's really helpful.
Ooh. Yeah. So I think
that's brutal
it
game design.
I think it's important to talk about the big change they made to the overworld in this game, which is that it is not the overworld from The Legend of Zelda. Instead of being like the screen-by-screen situation that is basically functionally identical to the dungeon view, it is much more of a Dragon Quest abstracted overworld where you walk around and you can't fight anything. Like, enemies will appear and they'll bump into you, but then that takes you into a separate combat screen, which is, you know, side-scrolling. So it's much more of a traditional RPG in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they do some kind of clever things, like if you're walking on a road and enemies attack you, then you go to the sort of combat screen, but there's nothing there because you're like in a safe space. But otherwise, you know, the backgrounds kind of reflect where you are in the world map, like on a beach or in a rocky, craggy place full of weird bubbles that rise out of the water.
Yeah.
So it kind of reflects, you know, the sort of experience that you're having, the situation you're in.
But you're definitely in a corridor. You can explore little areas between mountains and villages and stuff, but you can't get to the further areas. So it's the beginning of the downhill slide for, like, not being an exploration-based Zelda. You can probe the edges of each area, and there's some cool stuff. You find these, like, Stonehenge ruins, and there'll be a heart in there.
Mm.
It's really – those are, like, the parts of Zelda 2 where I'm like, oh, this is graphically interesting. And the rest of it looks like kind of a janky PC game from the time. It's very strange.
It looks like a typical
– like the villages?
Japanese action game for Famicom, honestly.
Mm.
It's very much a product of its time. You know, I think –
it's not pretty.
No, it's not. But, I mean, keep in mind that it's early 1987, and games started to look a lot better toward the end of 1987. So it was really pretty out of date by the time it made it to the U.S.
But I think Doki Doki looks really nice.
It does, but that was later. And actually, the Japanese version of Doki Doki Panic, you know, that's not –
it's a little bit more primitive than Mario 2.
Yeah, it is. Like, they polished it up a lot when they brought it to the U.S. a year later as Mario 2. So both of those games kind of benefited from the delays.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they both are, like – Zelda 2, I think, still looks like more of a product of its time, but because it is so large and complex and has the save feature and everything, it still felt pretty remarkable when it came out. But it definitely, you know, did kind of leave a little bit of a disappointed taste in my mouth when it came out.
I think if you can solve a lot of the problems that a lot of people have with Zelda with save states, as I mentioned earlier, it just makes it a lot less frustrating combat-wise and exploration-wise. But what it doesn't solve is there are adventure games, like 90s adventure games style puzzles in that game that you have to solve that make no sense. And of course, I Am Error is one of those.
Yeah.
There's two characters, Bagu, Bug, and Error. At one point, one of them says to go find Error. But the first time you go to Error, he just says, I Am Error over and over again. You have no idea what that means.
No, he tells you to find Bagu, doesn't he?
Yeah, he just says,
the
I
River
Am
Man.
Error.
Yeah, I don't know.
The River Man, I think, says talk to Bagu. Then he says go back to Error. Then there's also the I lost my mirror. This is a way to get a spell in a town. The solution to that I lost my mirror puzzle is to walk into one of the, you know, 10 houses. You don't know if it's you're going to find that mirror at the end of a cave, which you usually find stuff, right? You find a lost child in the end of a cave. You find something, you know, something else, a trophy at the end of a cave. But this, you just go into a house, and this is – you would never figure this out. I don't know how. You go to a table – and you duck down at the table. Every house has a table.
Oh, right.
And when you duck down at the table, it says, I found a mirror.
I think I can like envision the counselor's corner Nintendo Power section for this. Like, how do I find the mirror? And there's a picture of a guy with a windbreaker on.
The worst thing is the entire...
Wait, does he have a mullet? He has a mullet.
He has to have a mullet, yeah.
The worst thing in the game is the entire hidden town in a forest. And to find it, you have to go to that kind of obscure area of the world map. There's nothing else of interest over there. And you have to hit the exact space where the town is hidden with the hammer. Now, at no point does the game mention that the hammer is able to clear-cut forests.
Right.
It is. Like, if you try it, you can
do it
clear-cut forests.
Yeah. Okay.
But who would think, yes, I'm going to knock these trees down with a hammer?
Yeah.
And you
it's
know what
so
the clue to find the villages at all?
Yeah,
is that there's,
like,
a village
there's a village
that just kicks your ass. Because it's filled with invisible enemies, and everybody's moved because of that. So there's, like, no, like, hey, we moved sign. That's your clue. It's like the Croatoan, you know, or a sign in the early American civilization.
Oh, okay. So the clue is
what
that
do we
find
leave behind?
Village,
an empty
no
village.
People in it.
Yeah.
It's full of invisible enemies.
Yes.
Right. And
but
so
the thing
you
is,
must,
they
you're
also
supposed to think they must have gone somewhere.
Right.
I'll go hit trees until I find them.
And you know, since they're invisible, you just think, hey, is there a gas in this air that's taking my life?
Yeah, yeah.
There's no
real
way.
You have to find the cross.
Yeah. So then you go to that village. Then you have to go back to the other village and make the enemies visible. It's just mind-bogglingly convoluted. And you had to use guides to do this. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at that time, you could rely on Nintendo Power to give you that those answers.
I think we could assume that Zelda 2's strategy guide was one of those chart-topping books in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they didn't have an official strategy guide for Zelda 2.
No, in Japan. In Japan.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that surprising, though? I mean, Nintendo Power had a lot of stuff in it. That was great.
I mean, Nintendo Power, had,
but there
was unofficial
stuff.
Like the whole game.
There was no – yeah, I think they tried to maybe move over to Nintendo Power at that point for all your strategy needs. Because they stopped publishing strategy guides for a while. They had the Mario and the Zelda ones, and then that was pretty much it.
I picked up an off-brand Zelda guide as a joke that was from the Zelda 2 era. It had both games in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been using that.
Oh, I have that.
With Link, he just looks like a sissy, like very scared on the stairs.
Yeah, we
lantern.
Don't really use that word anymore. But, you know.
it's very funny. But that book was very helpful. It's computer-drawn maps on it and stuff like that. It's great.
I remember Zelda. I mean, Zelda 2 is one of those games where you would see tips in Nintendo Power years and years after the game was released. Like, you'd see things like Kid Icarus and Metroid in like a 90 issue of Nintendo Power. Like, there was always a need for these hints, you know, for kids.
Yeah, that was a game that really demanded you get help. Like, even more so than the first Zelda, which had some obscure parts. Like, what does it mean? You know, how do I find level 5? Or what does this tip mean? Like, northwest, southwest. What's that about? But for the most part,
what's the one about upgrade? You have to upgrade to come back and get this or something.
Oh yeah, master using this and you can have it.
And that just means come back with more hearts.
Yeah, like there was some stuff that you needed to kind of figure out or talk about. But Zelda 2 was just opaque. It was inscrutable, and that's probably the most frustrating part. When I played through it, I got stuck in it for probably like 3 weeks because I could get to the last dungeon. I'd beaten all the temples. I could get to the final palace. But I couldn't enter because I didn't have maxed out hearts. Mm. And you have to max out your life by finding all the heart containers before, I'm pretty sure this is right, before you can enter the final dungeon.
Dear God.
And I didn't know where it was. It turns out it was on this island maze that's kind of like hidden. And I had been to the island maze before, but I guess I hadn't walked into the right random block of the maze where you step and all of a sudden it puts you in a side view and there's a heart container.
Yep. Mm.
Or maybe it's a magic container. But
in any
case,
one out in the water that's really hard to find.
Yeah,
too. Man, you guys are making a phenomenal case for me to never,
me
ever
too.
Play this video.
But again,
game.
Save states and a game guide make it possible to kind of just explore this game that has
yeah.
things that Nintendo made that we will never see otherwise.
Right.
There is a really cool game here that with, you know, the hindsight of modern game design thinking and the idea that maybe you don't have to be a complete asshole to players, would be a really great game. I would love to see sort of a modern-day remake of this that just kind of takes out the horrible parts and just smooths over the bumpy bits.
Mm-hmm. I think people have been talking about that for a long time. And, I wouldn't be too surprised to ever hear that Nintendo had considered that at some point or, you know, worked up some prototypes of Zelda 2. But in general, they've pretty much just abandoned it.
Yeah.
But Kid Icarus got a nice 3DS remake. I always liked with a little bit of a floaty jump.
Yeah,
and,
right. They changed the jump on that and all of a sudden it becomes this playable, pretty fun game.
Oh, the 3D,
I love that
version.
Yeah, Erika just made like a little change to the way Link jumps. They didn't even take out the fact that when you duck, you fall through a platform.
Yeah,
no, they
like,
didn't.
They kept all the elements of the
I'm
game,
finished.
But they just changed the way you jump, and it changes everything about the game. It's much more playable.
Yep.
So
I think, you know, Zelda 2 would need a little more refinement than that, but it's still, there's still the heart of a good game here.
So maybe better clues, and then maybe those invisible pits. Take out those invisible pits. Those things are so mean.
Yeah.
You can't see them. There's no way to ever show the invisible. You just have to fall in them once, and then you have to jump over them the next time, and you don't know which brick it was, and oh my God. Final boss. So cool in that game. First, you fight a very difficult large boss, and then you go to get the Triforce. There's a little man holding the Triforce. I don't know who that little man is. He's up on a pillar.
Yoda, I think.
And you think, I'm finally at the end. There's the Triforce. And then all of a sudden, your shadow jumps out of you and just kicks your ass.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely an idea they've explored plenty of times since this game.
Yeah.
For sure.
Shadow Link is an Ocarina of Time. And in that game, I remember people saying like that he was so hard in that game, but there's tricks to him in that. But in this game, there's no trick. You just have to back him into a corner or just swat him.
You just have to
forever.
Outfight him. But, I mean, you use the exact same tactics that you did with the knights and everything. And, you know, to get to that point, you have to fight through the Great Palace where you don't just fight those knight guys, but the flying bird, the Fokers or whatever they're called.
With hammers?
Yeah.
They're basically hammer brothers.
They're
so bad.
They're like birds and knights, and they're just terrible. Mm. They're horrible. The final boss is nothing compared to that. But one of the interesting things is that to be able to damage, to be able to hurt the final boss, the next to last boss, the Firebird,
yeah,
the Phoenix or whatever it's called.
You have to use a spell.
You have to use a spell that uses half your magic meter if you've maxed it out. So
plus
that,
you have to use shield and jump.
Yeah, you have to use shield and you have to use jump and shield. So you can't really rely on like the life spell.
Until
like, it pretty
you
much
get to
drains your magic.
Shadow Link, and then if you have a life, you die. And then you have your full life again. Mm. And that's the thing about that Great Palace. You can get extra lives in Zelda 2.
Mm-hmm.
But they're on the map screen and they're in other places. They're even in dungeons. But you can only get them once. So
yeah,
if you wait your whole game and spend two lives and everything and then just do a run to get all the extra lives, that's the way to beat the Great Palace. Otherwise, it's too hard.
Then can you save your game?
No. You'll lose
you
them.
Can't
you have
save
one
it, yeah.
chance. You have to do that run.
It's like the E-Tanks in Mega Man 2.
One save.
Wow.
the one nicety is that if you make it to the Great Palace and die – and continue, you continue from the beginning of the Great Palace.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have enough lives to beat it at that point, so
I've done it.
That is the one save point in the game outside of the Zelda's castle, right?
Yeah. That's the only other one. So I've just played it, and I do recommend playing it on 3DS with save states on your commute. You can do it in bite-sized chunks, and you just look up game help when you need it, and it's totally worth it in that sense. I had a great time playing it. Actually, like I really like
it. Is there any – so, I mean, yeah, would this be a game in which you would say just start playing it and then if you need help, you know, go to the FAQ? Or, because there's some games where I would say –
I would use walkthroughs
to like,
skip the parts you've played because you've played those so many times. You've gone to that Great Palace probably and gone to the caves. But, like, just get through that and then explore a little bit. But always know what your next goal is.
Okay.
Like, you know, just an outline is good enough. Otherwise, it's not a fun exploration game. It's a combat game.
Gotcha.
It's good to know. And then upgrade that sword.
Yeah. Chris said if you get stuck. I can't imagine a scenario someone playing this fresh wouldn't get stuck.
Yeah,
know?
That's
so
the
when,
thing. You
yeah.
have
when
to know where
stuck.
To go.
When you get stuck.
If you know
yeah,
the
but there's
points,
some there's some games in which I would recommend that people like start the game and just use a FAQ because that game is going to tell you don't do this. Like, here's things to not do.
That's a really
here's
good
things to go do that are going to make your gameplay experience better.
There's actually a website for that. I think it's called, like, Before I Play or whatever. Google that.
Oh,
and
yeah?
And it'll be like, here's what you should do. There's, like, no spoilers. Like, don't do this. Make sure you do this just to, like, have a better time.
We
make
those
guys
That's
for
really
Dark
cool.
Souls games
idea.
And stuff like that a lot.
Yeah.
Earthbound is a really good game to play with the original strategy guide because the strategy guide is not a strategy guide. It's like...
That's
it's
right.
like an index of like all the stuff it doesn't tell you.
And it's like
if you have $300, grab that guide. Yeah.
It's also like
great PDF version.
The PDF is available officially. Oh, okay. Yes.
It's also designed to be like an artifact of the world with like newspaper articles and you know just like
right,
fun
totally.
Information
well,
about
also,
that universe.
Yeah.
Cool. I think that's such a clever thing to release your book guide as like, hey, this is what we couldn't fit in the game.
Yeah.
And it just makes it better.
I believe
and
it's
of
a,
course, as we know, you know, the fan gamer guys will bring them up again, did the Mother 3 handbook, which is exactly that.
Beautiful.
But for Mother 3. I was reading that thing, and I was like, oh, man, how'd they get all these cool, like, you know, clay versions of the characters, just like the Earthbound guide? They must have scanned these out of a Japanese guide. Nope. They frickin' made clay versions of all the characters that look amazing and then photographed them
That's
for the
so
guide.
Cute.
Yeah.
We love them. They make our T-shirts. So please buy one of those, too.
Right.
We'll be right back.
So anyway, we really need to wrap it up. Yeah. And I don't know that we really have too much more to say about Zelda 2, but I did want to mention the fact
Beautiful opening. Beautiful opening for Zelda 2.
Yeah, especially if you play the Famicom Disk System version.
Oh, right,
the American
right.
version, you know, didn't have the sound channel, so it loses something, and it's very kind of shrill.
Like, there's a warbly nature to it that I don't like.
Yeah, it's much nicer in the Japanese version, and I hate saying that because it sounds so pretentious.
Oh, you wanted to talk about you wanted to talk about Zelda 2's influence on Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, so
The names of the towns in Zelda 2 were the names of the seven sages in Ocarina of Time.
Yep.
And of course, that's Ocarina of Time takes place before Zelda 2. So what happened was the names of the seven sages, we all named our towns after the sages of old, right?
Right. So it's a nice callback. But the director of... the director of both games was Yoichi Yamada.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that was the last Zelda game he directed. After that, it was, you know, Aonuma. So I don't know. I guess he went on to executive heaven or whatever. I always felt like Ocarina of Time took a lot of cues from Zelda 2 because combat in Zelda and Zelda Link to the Past and Link's Awakening was very just kind of like stab, spin.
You know
what? Whereas Zelda 2 is really heavily focused on sword skills and on like standing toe-to-toe with enemies. And they
Nose to nose,
toes to toes.
Right up to them, and then stab them with your tiny sword.
You are absolutely correct. I mean, in the main, what happened with the Zelda series is like, oh, why didn't they make another Zelda 2? Well, the answer is, after Link to the Past, it became moot. The top-down Zeldas and the side-scrolling Zeldas all became one game, which is the 3D Zeldas taking elements from both and moving on as a series.
Well,
with
the Game
all
Boy
of
games,
that
for some reason,
about.
Stuck with the top-down.
A side-scrolling, well, right, exactly. Yeah. So a side-scrolling Zelda at this point would be a deliberate throwback-type game design.
Yeah, it's weird.
Which maybe they will. But yeah, you're right. I mean, when Zelda
When I first played Ocarina of Time, I was like, okay, this is Zelda 2, but they took the camera from the side and put it behind Link.
Mm-hmm.
But it really does feel like, in terms of kind of the mechanics and play, like they really reached back to Zelda 2 and said, this is how we make, you know, kind of like strong, engrossing combat. You know, they added the Z targeting, which made a huge difference. But just the element of the one-to-one combat that there's so much of in Ocarina of Time was very much a Zelda 2 thing. I mean, you spend so much time fighting the knights and the bosses and everything.
Right, you and here's an enemy, and you have to dance with that enemy exclusively, rather than you're in a room and there's three enemies and they're sort of wandering around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
this is why you hate Ocarina of Time.
I can't stand that game. No.
You never beat it though, right? Isn't that one that you never got through?
Have I beaten it? I can't remember. I've played most of it, if not beaten it, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just doesn't. I don't hate it. It just isn't one of my favorites. Like I never felt. This kind of immense, like, oh, I love this game. Whereas I did beat Zelda 2. So,
yeah.
So there you go. But no, I really feel like, you know, Zelda 2's legacy was kind of showing the way forward for a very heavy combat-driven game. And that's something that Zelda games outside of Zelda 2 had not excelled at. So, you know, if that's the lasting legacy of Zelda 2, it's a pretty good one because the way Nintendo handled combat in Zelda 2 really kind of revolutionized 3D action games. It's become kind of the standard, really.
The one good part of it was what they carried on, and then everything else went into the dumpster of time.
You guys remember the little neat fact that there was a downward stab that was attempted to be put into Ocarina of Time?
Oh, really?
Just couldn't figure it out.
They tried, but they just couldn't do it. Yeah, it makes sense.
But it got the jump slash.
Yeah. Yep.
Based on Chris's comment, I want to play Legend of Zelda: The Dumpster of Time.
Yeah.
Sifting through these thrown away ideas.
I think that was on CDI.
Oh, wow. Burn.
Anyway, so any final thoughts on Zelda or Zelda 2 as we wrap this up?
I never thought I'd endorse playing it, but it's because it's a first party, such a mega hit Nintendo game that most people I know haven't beat or played. That's why I went back to play it. And that's why I'm here talking about it. When you brought it up, I was like, I want to talk about Zelda 2. And then that made me get through the rest of the Great Palace this week. So it was one of the better archaeology experiments I've had with a game recently.
Yeah, not everything Nintendo creates is gold, even if they put it in a gold cartridge.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah, thanks.
Well done.
But there are a lot of really interesting ideas in Zelda, and it really was this I'd say a pretty influential game in its own regard. There were other games that kind of did the Zelda 2 thing in the following years, like Fazanadu, a few others, you know, that they did sort of the action platformer RPG adventure thing and did it better than Zelda 2. And, you know, Symphony of the Night probably is sort of the ultimate synthesis of that and Metroid, like Zelda, Zelda 2, Super Metroid, all in one. Oh, and also some Castlevania. Mm-hmm. And
just a touch.
Yeah, just a bit. But, you know, that's really, I think, what they were trying for with Zelda 2, but the technology wasn't there. The game design philosophy and you know, sort of mindfulness of the actual player experience wasn't quite there. So it's an interesting experiment and a remarkable attempt that isn't always that much fun. But I definitely think it's wrong for people to just dismiss it out of hand because there's a lot happening in that game. And, you know, parts of it did survive throughout Zelda and have influenced both that series and other series as well.
Yeah, and we have, you know, a sense of shade and fraud. We want other people to suffer through this
game.
Yeah,
sure.
I want to see them suffer through it.
As for me, Zelda has kind of lost me in recent years, but I will always love games the most that borrow from the earlier Zelda games, games that encourage exploration, games that are confident enough for you to get lost.
Here.
Yeah. And Link Between Worlds, probably my favorite Zelda game of the past 15 years, probably. Yeah.
It's a secret to everybody.
Well said. All right, folks, that wraps it up for episode 21 of Retronauts, or whatever episode this was. And thanks to Chris and Sam for coming in to talk about Zelda.
Good to be with you.
Hey.
Thanks for Bob for talking about Zelda also.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to you, the player, for listening. And thanks to me for, I don't know, whatever the hell I did. So we'll be back in a week with some kind of micro episode. And 2 weeks from now with a big episode hosted by Bob. It's going to be awesome. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast at retronauts.com, at usgamer.net, and, of course, on the iTunes store. This podcast is made possible by Patreon. So please check out patreon.com/retronauts and make a small pledge to us so that we can keep doing this and renting this space with no ventilation. It's really important. Mm-hmm.
Retronauts. It's a safe space.
That's right.
Because we're actually inside a safe.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Wow.
So a nuke could drop and we'd all be safe.
That's right.
Totally.
Forever, you know, anytime I come out of an episode recording session, I'm like, is civilization still here? Okay. The electricity's still on. We're good. So, yeah. Also, finally, we're on Twitter, Facebook, etc. So check us out on social media. As for myself, you can find me at usgamer.net, where I work, and you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and also check out GameBoy.world, which is where I write about Game Boy games, because why the hell not?
I love that site.
Sam.
Hey, you can find me at Samuel_IGN. I do a lot of retro game coverage for IGN, and you can come play my pinball machines at Free Gold Watch at Hate and Stanley when you come to San Francisco. It's a great arcade.
Hmm. I am on a podcast called Good Job Brain, which you should listen to. It has nothing to do with video games whatsoever, but I really enjoy doing it. Goodjobbrain.com. I'm the games editor at Wired, where I do write about the video games. So Wired.com for me.
And you can find my writing at usgamer.net and somethingawful.com. And I do another podcast called Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. We should be in the middle of season 3 by the time you hear this, so check it out. It's a lot of fun, and I have a lot of fun doing it.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Nintendo, for making Zelda games. All right, that's it for us. Take care. Bye.
2 luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.